Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
Welcome you to the Tuesday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. And we are spending today's morning show talking about something fundamental to all of our lives, food. It is something we cannot live without, but it is also something that if we're not careful or wise in the choices we make, it can be something that takes over our lives and takes over our well-being and undercuts what otherwise might be a very happy and successful life. In other words, our relationship to food can be one of passion and love, and sometimes it can be a love-hate relationship. Sometimes it can lead us down some really scary, self-destructive paths. One of the most illuminating books I have ever read on the topic, and I've read a lot of books on the topic, is the one I have just finished called Food, We Need to Talk. The science-based, humor-laced last word on eating, diet, and making peace with your body. It is co-authored by two writers. First of all, Dr. Edward M. Phillips, Associate Professor of Physical Medicine and Rehabilitation at Harvard Medical School and founder of the Institute of Lifestyle Medicine, and my morning show guest, Yuna Jatta, a Harvard graduate who studied neuroscience and music there, and someone who has lived a rich, full, varied life, but also a life that has included a somewhat complicated relationship with food. And the way in which these two came together have co-created a marvelous podcast and now a book of the same name is interesting in and of itself. But beyond that, they bring various perspectives to bear on this so important topic of our relationship with the food we eat. And I'm very excited about this opportunity to speak with Yuna Jatta about this book, again titled Food, We Need to Talk, the science-based, humor-laced last word on eating, diet, and making peace with your body, published by St. Martin's Press. Yuna Jatta, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you so much for having me, Greg. I'm so excited to be here.
So it would probably be helpful for us to begin with kind of a personal sketch of you and your life, including where you come from originally and so on, and the path that ultimately led you to cross paths with Dr. Edward Phillips, your co-author and your collaborator on the podcast.
Sure. So I was born in Albania. And my family came here around when I was 5. And all growing up, I always had 2 very skinny sisters. And I was never overweight, but I was never as skinny as my sisters. So whenever I was growing up, I was always thinking like, oh, I wish I was just, 10, 15 pounds lighter. Wouldn't it be so great? Yada, yada, yada. And when I got to college at Harvard, because my parents weren't there anymore watching what I was doing, I was basically free to diet as much as I wanted to, exercise as much as I wanted to without anybody watching. And so I started eating only 1,000 calories a day, going to the gym for an hour a day, and I was able to, maintain this for, 2-3 weeks. And after that, I started binge eating whenever I would get too far into the diet. So it would be like, I was so good. I was eating so little. I was exercising so much. I lose so much weight. And then I would not be able to take it anymore, and it would lead to a binge eating episode. And so this cycle of restricting and binging continued all throughout college, and it led to me being the unhealthiest I had ever been. So growing up, even though I'd always wanted to lose weight, I'd never been overweight. But the dieting and binge eating was the first time in my life when I actually became overweight. And it led to so many hormonal problems, not the weight, but the fasting and the not eating led to me not having my period for years and having the hormonal profile of what my doctor called a menopausal woman, in quotations. So that's kind of what really got me interested into health and fitness, was because I was like, I know I'm doing something wrong, but I don't know how to stop, because the only way I ever knew to lose weight was to not eat. And so it really got me interested in the science-based research behind nutrition, weight loss, metabolism, and exercise. And once I felt like I had done all this research into the topic, I approached my local NPR station, and I said, guys, you guys should really be covering this topic, because there's so much misinformation and so many people peddling snake oil and supplements for weight loss that don't work. And I feel like there should be a reputable source on this information. And that is how the podcast started. So my NPR station had done a podcast with Eddie, Dr. Phillips, years prior. And they said, wouldn't it be great if we put you guys together and you guys can do a podcast about food? And so that's how Food We Need to Talk was born back in 2018. And the book comes out this year.
I think one of the things that's really intriguing about the podcast, I've not had a chance to listen to it a lot, but what I have heard, I have really enjoyed and found fascinating, as I did your book, is the two of you are such an intriguing pair. You work together beautifully, but it's not like you're two peas in a pod. I mean, you have distinct personalities and, of course, very distinct sort of areas of expertise, in a sense. And I really think it's a team that works exceedingly well. How about the actual writing of this book? What did that project feel like? What kind of a collaboration did it represent? And I mean, how did the two of you actually put this book together?
Yeah, so you're totally right. Eddie and I come from very different backgrounds. Eddie is in his 60s. He has three kids that are all my age. I'm 27 and obviously just graduated college, 5 years ago. So it is one of the great things about the podcast and the book that we have this relationship where I say he's kind of my American dad because, my parents are very, very Eastern European. But I call him my American dad because we can have the kinds of conversations that are oftentimes very hard to have with your actual family. And so we kind of have that father-daughter relationship without having all the emotional baggage of having grown up with each other for 27 years. And in terms of the book writing process, Eddie actually has a real job. He is a doctor and an associate professor. So his time is much more limited than mine. So a lot of the book writing came down to me. Eddie also doesn't love writing as much as I do. I've always grown up a writer. I've gotten works published all through growing up and all through college. And so I was really excited to do the writing, and Eddie was really excited to do the proofreading. So Eddie spent so much of the time reading all my sections, being so careful about it. And then after I had written the chapter and done all the citations, which since I'm fresh out of college, I was like, oh my gosh, I have been trained for this my whole life. This is exactly what I know how to do. Then Eddie would write his response to the chapters from the doctor's perspective or the father's perspective. So you'll get both perspectives in the book. Some of the chapters are written just by me. Some of the chapters are written just by Eddie. But in any chapter that we write, we always have the other person's perspective as well. So I think that's another really unique thing about the book, is that you get two different perspectives on a topic from very different backgrounds and outlooks on life.
Hmm. One of the things I want to mention is that although the book is chock full of really good information, it is also a deeply personal book, and it becomes especially personal at two different points. First of all, there's chapter 8, which is titled Too Fat to Have an Eating Disorder, in which you really spell out your own complicated relationship with food. And then the following chapter, chapter 9, From a Dad, which features a very honest conversation between Dr. Phillips and his daughter, Becca, who also wrestled with eating disorders. And it's really interesting how we kind of make our way through all kinds of information and then suddenly we find ourselves in this slightly different place where the two of you are each telling your own deeply personal stories. I find that really, really fascinating. I'm so glad that's part of the book. And it's interesting that those very personal stories come where they do, well into the book, chapter 8 and chapter 9. Do you remember talking at all about including this in the first place, and also how it would be included and where it would be included within the framework of this overall book?
Yeah, so I wrote this in the book, and I've also said this in the podcast when we've had our eating disorders episode. Whenever we do anything about eating disorders, I get this feeling in my heart like everything we're doing is for this episode, and the point of this entire book is this chapter. And like you said, in both the podcast and the book, actually, it's never how we start out. It's always kind of deeper into it. And I think it's because, like you said, it's such an emotionally fraught topic that I think we kind of skate around it all the time with all this information. But at the end of the day, I do feel like for me, it was the crux of the book. It was why I wrote the book. It was the first part of the book I ever wrote, was the eating disorders chapter. And I got the idea, like, I would say verbatim, when I was on a meditation retreat. I was doing a 10-day silent retreat right before we started writing the book. And I just remember knowing exactly how I would start the chapter, knowing exactly what I would write about. And as soon as I came home from the retreat, it was the first thing I wrote. It was the first thing I sent to my editor. So it was kind of the heart of the book. And originally, we had thought I would write the eating disorders chapter because I had such a personal, you know, relationship with it. And like with a lot of the other chapters, Eddie would write a couple pages at the end responding, talking about his relationship with his daughter. So he asked his daughter, you know, can I ask you about the eating disorder? And they started talking. And what was supposed to be a few pages turned into his whole chapter on eating disorders as well with his daughter. And Eddie's chapter is also written as a conversation. So it's actually a transcript of the conversation that they had between each other, which I think is also really unique. And I'm so grateful to have that perspective because it's truly a conversation that I still feel like I haven't really had with my parents, because it's so emotionally difficult for both parties, I think, because no parent wants to hear about their child's pain in graphic detail, right? So I think it was really therapeutic even for me to read his chapter and for him to have the conversation with his daughter about it, because I don't think they had candidly talked about it as well. Mm. And if you get the audiobook, actually, the book is read by me and Eddie, but that chapter with Eddie and his daughter is read by him and his daughter. So you'll actually get to hear their voices speaking their parts, which I think is also really, really cool.
Wonderful. One thing that is intriguing about that story is, of course, again, we're talking about a father who is a medical doctor and well-versed in all kinds of matters related to the human body and nutrition and so on, and a devoted father, loving father, who did all that he could to raise his children as any loving parent would. And he had to kind of come to terms with the fact that he perhaps, for all of his expertise, had inadvertently played some kind of role in contributing to what ultimately sort of befell Becca. At one point, he says to Becca, "It wasn't until your diagnosis that I started to wrestle with the conundrum that all this focus on food and exercise might backfire, and for some, create an environment promoting eating disorders." I mean, that really points to something that isn't just part of their story, but when one is concerned about this, it is so easy for that interest and concern to sort of flip over into another place in which what should be a wonderful part of life becomes a big problem in life.
Exactly. And I think that's one of the main ideas of the book, is that we present this information, but always with the warning that anything can be taken too far, and there is a place for moderation in all aspects of health. Eddie tells a story when he was talking to his daughter that he said, like, "I'm so sorry if we caused this for you and if we played a part in, you know, creating your problem with food and anorexia. And she said to him, well, there was a natural experiment going on in the house because I have two siblings and neither of them have eating disorders and they grew up in the same house. So it's never, you know, 100% it's the parents, it's the environment, it's the society. It's always going to have to do with the individual, too, having a predisposition for things like perfectionism or black and white thinking that is also contributing. But we always have to keep in mind who we are when we are taking in information. Like, I am very much like Becca and the type of person that if I hear something like fasting is good for you, then I'll say, okay, great, I'm going to do a 3-day fast. Whereas somebody else might hear fasting is good for you and be like, okay, maybe I'll try just stopping eating at 8 p.m., which is like a normal thing to do, right? So you have to kind of be self-aware and think to yourself, like, am I the type of person that takes things too far and hold yourself back from doing more damage to your mental health than the benefit you're doing to your physical health?
Hmm. For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking today with Una Jatta, who is co-author with Dr. Edward M. Phillips of a really intriguing new book called Food, We Need to Talk, the science-based, humor-laced last word on eating, diet, and making peace with your body. And I do appreciate all of the information that is shared here and some of the insights that you share. And I want to give you a chance to kind of reiterate what you just said, which is, unlike so many books that have been written, this is not a book that prescribes what you should do. It really acknowledges the fact that, first of all, this is complicated ground we're on. The whole science of nutrition is very complicated. You talk about that a lot. And that it really is a big mistake to try to concoct some kind of magical one-size-fits-all solution for this. I mean, that is just not the goal of your book.
Absolutely. I mean, one of the biggest things that sets our book apart from other books is that we are not trying to sell something. We don't have a diet plan attached. You don't sign up for an exercise program. It is purely the science behind nutrition and metabolism and how all of these things work together. And it's really important to us that we did not add to the tribalism involved in nutrition. So nutrition has become this thing where it's like, people are on different teams. Like, I'm on the vegan team, I'm on the carnivore team, I'm on the keto team, and it becomes part of people's identity. And that is what we wanted to avoid at all costs in the book, because there is no one-size-fits-all answer for nutrition. We know that all the cultures in the world have such different traditions around food, and yet they all live long, healthy lives, and that actually the real thing that is damaging our health today is the toxic food environment we've created, where the focus is not on whole foods anymore and it's on manufactured food products that scientists are creating in a lab to be delicious, high calorie, and irresistible. So as long as you're focusing on whole foods, there's no wrong answer here.
Your book begins with a point of clarification that I really appreciated. Chapter one is essentially a brief history of dieting. And you remind us that the word diet in and of itself does not mean, you know, making certain choices in order to lose weight. And that's how we always use the term diet now. And of course, that's not what that word itself actually means. Clarify what the word diet actually means and how helpful that can kind of be as we enter all this.
Yeah, so a diet is a pattern of eating. And I think the real problem comes when we add the word a. When you say this is a diet, automatically in our head, we are thinking this is a temporary thing, right? If you're on a diet, you're on it for 12 weeks. You're on it for 6 months. If you're a superstar, you are not on it for the rest of your life. And that is exactly the problem with diets. So when we say that 80% of diets fail, it is because they are by nature temporary. We think of them as something that we have to suffer through, that if we have enough willpower, we can make it through this next week or this next month until we have to go to the beach or until our wedding. And then after that, we can go back to what we were doing before and we'll keep the weight off. And that is exactly why most people will regain the weight and often regain even more weight than they lost. So if you are looking to make a change in your diet, not a diet, you need to have it be a change that you are comfortable making for the rest of your life. If you do not want to eat low-fat yogurt and salad for the rest of your life, then that's not something to be doing for 6 weeks, because it's going to end up backfiring and probably causing you even more problems down the road, which is why we're such big advocates of small changes. Like, even if you're like, I have a large coffee every day with tons of sugar in it, if you can cut that sugar in half, and that's already a massive change if you're making that for the rest of your life, right? Because it compounds over years and years and years of your life.
Right. I appreciate that part of the book, and I hope at the end we'll have a chance to just kind of run through a survey of some of those relatively small, very doable changes, like cutting out one dessert a week, or cutting out one store-bought dessert versus one that you make at home, those kind of shifts in our behavior, which can ultimately have a much more fundamental and sustainable change in our lives than some wildly flamboyant and fantastic diet that ultimately delivers temporary results on the positive and ultimately leads to other results in the negative. It's just a losing proposition all around. You proceed from a really interesting survey of the history of dieting and some of the things that men and women both have wanted, what it meant once upon a time to be thin versus plump versus what that means now. A really, really interesting survey. I encourage our listeners to explore. And then you get into some of the most complicated science in your book. And I'm so glad it's here, but you serve it up right up front, an examination of metabolism. Why is that right off the bat? And why did you think it was important to take the time that you do to explore the details of what metabolism is?
So it's right off the bat because it lays down the foundation for us to be able to talk in the rest of the book about all the other things we talk about. If you understand how metabolism and fat loss works, we can have a conversation about how does diet impact weight loss, how does exercise impact weight loss, sleep, stress, etc. If you don't understand how it works, then you probably are going to live your life a victim to the health marketing that we all see today. So because a lot of us don't have a fundamental understanding of metabolism, we kind of believe anything that anybody tells us that we want to believe, right? So when I was in college, like, I was a cognitive neuroscience major, so I was reading scientific papers all the time. And yet when I would go to the GNC and I would see pills that said proven to cause fat loss, I'd be like, oh, it says proven on the bottle. It must be proven. There are no regulations on supplements from the FDA. So a supplement can make any claim it wants on a bottle, and it does not have to be true. And because I read papers so much, there was some sort of scientific knowledge that I came to these things with. So there were certain words that I would know to look for. But the companies know that there are people looking for these words. So they'll say on their bottle, in randomized control trials, we have found XYZ. And again, there has to be zero validity to any claims they're making, right? So part of what I wanted to do in the beginning chapters was give the reader the confidence to be able to navigate health and fitness products with the knowledge base to know when things are wrong and when things are true. Because the vast majority of claims made on diet programs, exercise programs, and supplements are false or exaggerated.
That's really kind of scary, isn't it, when we think about what's out there?
It is. I mean, I cannot tell you how many pills I bought when I got to college because there was nobody there who could see what I was doing. And if there's no regulation within these pills, there can be who knows what sort of chemicals. Like, there have been pre-workouts, protein powders, weight loss pills taken off the shelves because they have steroids in them and it was not disclaimed. So there has been pre-workouts in the early 2000s that people would say, oh my God, when you take this pre-workout, you get so jacked afterwards. Yes, because there was testosterone in the pre-workouts. So it is really scary. It's a market that needs to be regulated more, and it doesn't look like anything's changing anytime soon. So being as health literate and as scientifically literate as possible is crucial.
So just to explore this matter of metabolism or total daily energy expenditure, which apparently is how scientists refer to this, we like to make a lot of kind of simplistic assumptions about how our metabolism functions and how, oh, once upon a time my metabolism was this, but now it's that. and you really tell us that, among other things, metabolism is kind of a moving target. It is something dynamic,
yes.
It adapts, and that when we make changes in our lives or experience different changes, metabolism, in a sense, changes right with it. And then stir into that the whole matter of how much our own metabolism happens to be genetic. It becomes something that is not all that easy to understand nor to manipulate.
Yes. So I'm so glad you brought that up, because when I was growing up and I was, like I said, always about 10 pounds heavier than my sisters, the answer for me was always, oh, it's my metabolism. Like, my parents would tell me, oh, it's your metabolism. You have a metabolism like me. You know, you have the genetics to have a stomach like me. But I'd be like, I was so confused, because I was like, my sisters have the same genetics. Why are they skinnier? I don't get it. So I always thought, oh, whatever it is, it must be this magical word, metabolism. Everybody uses it. It's the reason women struggle with their weight and men don't. It's the reason older women struggle more than younger women, et cetera, et cetera. And if you look into the research in metabolism, it actually turns out your metabolism, your metabolic rate, basically stays the same in your 20s, your 30s, your 40s, and your 50s, and then slightly starts to slow down in your 60s. And I know, hold on one second. I know a lot of people listening are probably thinking, there's no way that's true. I know for a fact, when I was in my 20s, I could lose weight so much more easily. I could eat whatever I wanted, and it was totally fine. And you are probably correct, but it is not because of your metabolic rate. It's because the younger we are, usually the more we move around in our daily lives. So there's four components of metabolism. And part of it is genetic, but part of it is also your body makeup, so how much muscle mass you have and how much you move around. And usually people in their 20s are quite active. They move around a lot. And as you get older, you move around less and less, and you also start to lose muscle mass. So if you are able to start a program of resistance training, which doesn't have to be that many minutes a week, it can be two times a week, half an hour, and you just apply resistance to your muscles, you can maintain your muscle mass all through your 30s, 40s, and 50s. And if you can find a way to keep your steps up in the day, to keep your movement up, so maybe you take walking meetings, maybe you walk the dog at the end of the day, you can keep the same metabolic rate all through middle age just by taking those precautions. And the other biggest thing I would say that we don't think about a lot with metabolism is the things to avoid for slowing down our metabolism. So for example, crash dieting. If you diet a lot, and then you gain the weight back, and then you diet again, and you gain the weight back, you will start to notice it gets harder and harder and harder to lose weight. And that's because every time you do a drastic dietary change where you take out a bunch of calories, your body is learning that this is not a secure food environment. We may not always have food, and it slows down its metabolism to adapt so that next time it's not going to lose as much weight, because our body is just trying to keep us alive. So if you can find a way to avoid crash dieting, you will also avoid those metabolic changes that often happen with yo-yo dieting.
Right. At one point you say, in trying to explain this, your body probably does not want you to just keep on losing weight forever. And in that respect, you know, your human, our own bodies will sort of work against us. You also mentioned something that can be a real issue when we talk about dieting and then letting go of a diet and things going to pot. You say that one reality of losing weight is that, at least in general, losing weight increases our appetite. And I guess if we're not prepared for that unhappy reality, then we're going to really get ourselves in trouble. And of course, more often than not, that's exactly what happens.
Yeah, and it's not only the increased appetite. So your body has a whole system of biological guardrails that it has built in to stop itself from withering away into nothing, right? there are not as many guardrails from stopping it from getting obscenely large, because that's never been a problem in the past. There are some, but there aren't as many. The guardrails from stopping it from getting underweight are very, very, very robust. So when you start losing weight, your appetite will increase because your body wants you to find more food, and it starts to think that food is more scarce, so it wants to increase food-finding activity. It increases the appetite hormones. It also lowers your natural desire to move. So if you just measure people on a diet and you don't tell them they have to move a certain amount, they will move around a lot less throughout their day than somebody not on a diet. It also starts to stop other functions. So for example, women who diet a lot may notice that they will lose their period. And that's because the reproductive system is a very energetically taxing system. So the body starts to conserve energy for other things. Men may notice they lose their libido. So if you look at male bodybuilders, they have virtually no sex drive in the weeks coming up to their show because their body fat levels get so low. So your body puts into place all these mechanisms to save energy and try to get you to get more energy to stop you from losing too much weight.
One really interesting part of the book, in a chapter titled Why All Diets Work Then Don't, which examines how a diet, I mean, almost every single diet will provide some sort of very short-term benefit, and then almost without exception, you go off that diet and your weight balloons, often higher than it once was. And you point, among other things, to a study of contestants from TV's The Biggest Loser. And there's Exhibit A of how not to lose weight. But anyway, there's a really helpful section in this chapter where you talk about those individuals who tend to escape this, that is, who manage to successfully maintain their weight loss. And what do these, in a sense, more successful people, when it comes to sustaining weight loss, what do they have in common? You tell us a couple of things. One of them is they tend to have less interest, for whatever reason, in comfort eating or emotional eating. That's not part of their makeup. That's not part of their relationship to food. But I wanted to especially have you talk about the other, which is that those who sustain their weight loss tend to have much less dichotomous thinking.
Yes.
And you explained dichotomous thinking, reducing everything to black and white. How does this typically play out, this kind of dichotomous thinking? How does it often sabotage someone's weight loss efforts?
Yes. Okay, this is so important. I'm so glad you brought this up, because the other habits are kind of not as interesting. It's like these people exercise, these people walk, these people eat whole foods, these people monitor their amounts. You're like, okay, yeah, shocking, these people kept off the weight, right? But then when you look at their psychological factors, it becomes much more interesting. And the dichotomous thinking, I think, is so important, because when we look at people who do extreme dieting, it is the exact opposite. They have very high amounts of black and white thinking. So an example is, you know, I ate really good today because I hit my calorie target. If they went over, let's say they had an extra cookie, okay, I went over 150 calories, I have ruined the day. The day is a disaster. This day is a failure. Now I might as well ruin it and I have 50 cookies. That is black and white thinking. It's like one thing being imperfect all of a sudden destroys the entire thing. So when you do something like that, your dieting becomes like what I was doing in college. It's like you have 5 days perfect, 3 days off the rails, 2 days perfect, 4 days off the rails. And it becomes this sort of last supper eating, like, oh, diet starts tomorrow. I just have one day to eat whatever I want. And then tomorrow I'm going to be so restrictive. I'm going to be so good. And that's going to be when everything happens. The body does not have a magical calorie counter that resets at midnight. The calories are constantly being averaged out over the days, the weeks, the months, the years. There's no such thing as a magic erase button. So this idea that you can have one really good day, one really bad day, one really good day, it's just not sustainable. What would be so much better is if you gave yourself some forgiveness and said, it's okay to have a cookie sometimes. I actually really want a cookie today. I've been craving it. Have that one cookie, enjoy it, and then move on and get back to your regular food, right? So if you have more self-compassion in the way you eat and have a more moderate dieting strategy or even a more moderate eating strategy. Like, I eat well most of the time. You try to be a B student instead of an A plus student, you are much more likely to be consistently in that B plus to A minus range than having A plus F, A plus F, A plus F.
Hmm. As you write, dichotomous thinking is reducing everything to black and white. I didn't reach my goal weight, so I'm a failure. I ate one cookie, so I blew the diet. I'm not where I want to be. I'm a failure. Fortunately, behavior change is generally much more subtle than glowing success versus unmitigated failure. And we just have to step away from that framework that we like to create, a simplistic framework that does not serve us well. For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Una Jatta, who is co-author with Dr. Edward Phillips of Food, We Need to Talk, the science-based, humor-laced last word on eating, diet, and making peace with your body. The book springs out of a podcast of the same name by Una Jatta and Dr. Phillips. I want to be sure that we take a moment to talk about Chapter 5, when you get to the matter of food, what we should eat, and you talk about how we find ourselves in the age of nutritionism. And this, if there is a dirty word for you and your co-author, it is nutritionism. That is, this is something that has led us into all kinds of trouble. First of all, explain what you mean by nutritionism. I mean, at a glance, it seems like something that would be a good thing that we should all be fully embracing.
Right. So nutritionism is reducing food down to its nutrient components. So instead of salmon being a piece of salmon, it is a vehicle for omega-3 fatty acids. Instead of rice being rice, it's a whole grain, right? If you just reduce food down to its nutrients, what this allows is a comparing of things that are really not the same. So for example, somebody can add vitamin D to their Captain Crunch, right, which a lot of cereals are fortified with a bunch of vitamins and minerals, and say, look, this Captain Crunch is an excellent source of vitamin D. And that vitamin D is not the same as the vitamin D you are getting from the sun. So nutritionism really became a part of the conversation in the 1960s when instead of making the dietary guidelines about food, there was a lot of food lobbyists involved in the government's dietary guideline creation. And they first came out, they had names of foods in the guidelines. Lobbyists got involved. And so instead, the guidelines included words like saturated fat. So back in the 1950s and 60s, heart disease was the biggest killer in America. It was thought that saturated fat was causing heart disease. And so the guidelines came out and said, reduce saturated fat. To give a brief summary of what happened next, processed food manufacturers learned of this. They said, oh, great. All we need to do is take out the saturated fat. That got replaced with high fructose corn syrup. And heart disease did tiny, tiny, tiny amount decrease. And instead, we had a ballooning of the new killer diseases of today, which are diabetes and related metabolic disorders. So I can tell you right now, the amount of fat in the American diet did not decrease, even though supposedly we were all cutting out saturated fat, right? The amount of sugar tripled, quadrupled in that time period because of this change in guidelines. And it was because we focused on this one thing, saturated fat, and we didn't really focus on our diet quality. So we focused on saturated fat for a while, then they decided that actually wasn't the issue. We then focused on cholesterol. Then it was decided that wasn't the issue. Then we focused on LDL cholesterol. Then it was decided that wasn't the issue. It's like we keep changing this target of like, what is the actual problem? What is the actual problem? The actual problem is the toxic food environment that we live in today, which is made up of ultra-processed foods. And ultra-processed food manufacturers have the advantage of being able to change the label on their food to reflect whatever nutrient is in style at the moment. So for example, today, protein is a very sexy macronutrient today. So a processed food manufacturer can make a brownie. It says high protein brownie. And people will think, rightly so, oh, this must be a healthy brownie. It says high protein. It's still a brownie. People can say gluten-free water. There was never gluten in water, but because it says gluten-free, people think, oh, this is healthy. Unfortunately, Whole Foods has no marketing budget behind them. They have no label saying vitamin A, E, and C rich broccoli on sale today, right? There's nothing on it that says that. And so it becomes this war between the marketing budget spent on processed food that, with the help of nutritionism, can be marketed as something it's not, and the complete lack of funding and lack of education around what whole foods are and how they actually contribute to our health.
And I appreciate so much that you kind of clarify this for us. I mean, the fact that there are whole foods, minimally processed foods, and then these ultra-processed foods, and you kind of give us a list. Sodas, cookies, chips, cakes, breakfast cereals, energy bars, baking mixes, packaged snacks, those all fall under this heading of ultra-processed foods, and we really need to be careful about how much of those we consume. And a little later in the same page, you write, real food does not have health claims on its packaging. Real food rots. Real food is not usually sold where gas is sold. You get the idea. This good reminder. And really tied up in all of this is the problem of reducing food to its nutrients. I mean, like, talking about food in that kind of selective way. And we need to, in a sense, have just a healthier relationship and understanding of food itself and what food is better for us and what food we need to be really careful about.
Yeah, the food journalist Michael Pollan has actually proposed that ultra-processed food should not be called food. Like, a Twinkie is not food. It is a food-like substance. It's been created in a factory, in a lab. There's been research done to make this Twinkie be as tasty as possible. The human brain is developed to love fat and to love sugar because in nature, fat and sugar are signals of high calorie density, right? So the brain loves those two things. And in ultra-processed foods, they are put together in a way that they are never put together in nature. There is no food in nature that has sugar and fat combined. Ultra-processed food, it's every single item is high fat and high sugar. And so when you eat these things, your brain is like, oh, this is delicious. This is so good. That's why you can't eat just one chip. That's why it's so hard to stop at one cookie. It's because it's so delicious. And when they do studies on rats, they will give rats ultra-processed foods like cheesecake, and the rats will binge on them and gain a bunch of weight. They take the cheesecake away and they give the rat back its regular rat food. The rat would rather starve than eat the rat food because that is how bad the rat food tastes in comparison to the cheesecake. So the ultra-processed foods really alter your brain chemistry to prefer the taste of them so much more than to real food. And so if you really want to start loving real food again, you have to take this period where you are reducing ultra-processed foods and trying to cut them out of your diet as much as possible in order to get reacclimated to what real food tastes like. And it's just like you said, real food, it goes bad. It's on the perimeters of the grocery store. It's food that people would have recognized as food 200 years ago. Like, if you showed somebody 200 years ago a Twinkie, they wouldn't know what it was. If you showed them an apple, they would know exactly what it was. So we have to think about those things when we're going to the grocery store and creating our meals.
I want to give you a chance to talk about an important section of the book in the chapter, What to Eat, in which, first of all, you and your co-author, and I think this is actually primarily Dr. Phillips at this point, spelling out some of these relatively modest changes one can make in one's life in terms of just decreasing the amount of the soda you drink or the juices, sugar-sweetened beverages, decreasing maybe even by just one or two how many fast food meals you eat in a week, eliminating some of those ultra-processed foods we were talking about. I mean, all of these incremental changes that can make such a difference. And then there is a list of takeaways that I think are really interesting. Eat real food. Diversify your food. Prepare your own food. Eat the right amount of food. Enjoy your food. Those five items. I think all five of those make all the sense in the world. But I want you to explain that last one. Why is it important, just beyond the pleasure of it, to enjoy our food? And what kind of problems do we get into if we fail to do that?
Yeah, that's such an important point. So we spend so much time talking about what to eat, what not to eat, blah, blah, blah. It's all this information, right? At the end of the day, we forget that food is a source of joy. It's something we have to partake in every day of our lives for the rest of our life, right? Might as well enjoy it while you're doing it, right? If you don't enjoy your food, you are not going to be paying attention to how much you're eating. You're not going to be paying attention to how you're cooking it. You are more likely to overeat, to eat quickly, to eat mindlessly. And so the more joy we can take in preparing our food, in finding healthy foods that we love, and then as we're eating them, actually really savoring it, the better you are going to eat. And even in those times when you do indulge, because we also say in this book, like, everything in moderation, if you want to have cake on your birthday, please have cake on your birthday. But know that the few bites of a dessert are always going to be the most delicious bites. So you are going to enjoy the most biochemically. You are going getting the most dopamine from that dessert in the first few bites of that food. So really taking the time to enjoy what you're eating is going to help you eat better in the long run. And if you don't enjoy what you're eating, you're probably going to eat worse.
Mm. It's so important. And of course, our casual relationship with food, which is available at every place we go, that can contribute to this mindlessness when it comes to the food we eat and why we are choosing it. Real quick, why is there a chapter about sleep in your book?
Thank you. Thank you for asking about this. I am so passionate about this topic. Okay, if we think about sleep, right? You are incapacitated. You are unable to run away from a predator. You are unable to fight. You are lying somewhere, completely not doing anything to further your survival. You're not reproducing. You're not finding food. You are in the weakest, most vulnerable state you can possibly imagine. And the human body has evolved to spend a third of our lives in this weak, vulnerable state, right? So if you think about evolutionary biology, you have to think to yourself, something crucial must be happening during this time for our body to spend a third of our lives doing this. And the answer is there are so many things happening while you sleep, and sleep science is such a new science. It's only been in the past few decades that we've started to find out what exactly is happening when you sleep. Prior to this, we had no idea why we slept. We thought maybe there was some sort of repair process happening. Maybe it was because we needed to dream and that was important. There are so many things. Your brain is cleaning itself out when you sleep. The plaques that build up that cause Alzheimer's disease, those plaques and the protein that causes those plaques is being flushed out of your brain when you are sleeping. Your memories are being consolidated when you are sleeping. It's how we learn. It's how we create new motor skills. It's how our body heals. And if you're pursuing weight loss and you don't sleep enough, you lose half the fat and lose double the muscle if you're not sleeping enough and you're on a diet. So if you care about your health, I would say sleep is one of the biggest things that will make a massive difference in your overall longevity, in your chronic disease risk, in your brain functioning and your body functioning. That is not that difficult to change, and it is simply a mindset thing that we need to be prioritizing sleep so much more than we are today. When I was in college, we would brag about how little sleep we would get. It would be like, oh, you slept for 3 hours? I slept for 2 hours. Oh, I pulled an all-nighter. You know what I mean? So it's not, the coffee is not the answer. The energy drinks are not the answer. Screens before bed are not the answer. We need to be thinking about our sleep a lot more than we are today. And that's why, I mean, I wanted to have a chapter doubly as long as that in the book, but there is a whole chapter on sleep in the book.
Hmm. Well, this book is really amazing, and it gave me so much to think about. And I know anyone else who takes it in hand will find all kinds of valuable information and lots of humor as well. The book, again, is titled Food, We Need to Talk, the science-based, humor-laced last word on eating, diet, and making peace with your body published by St. Martin's Press, and one of its authors, Una Jada. Una Jada, thank you so much for giving the world this book and for joining me today on The Morning Show to talk about it. What a pleasure.
Thank you, Greg. This was so much fun.
Tomorrow on The Morning Show, Amy Grile, Executive Director of the Kenosha Community Foundation. And on Thursday,